The opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. To find out more about this talk show or other talk shows broadcasting on KUCI, log on to our website at kuci.org or check out the latest program guide.
Good morning and welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org and always available via podcast. We are on iTunes. We are now on Amazon. We're on Stitcher. Wherever you consume your podcasts, we are on most platforms under Writers on Writing. You can follow us on Facebook, Writers on Writing. You can follow us on Twitter, WOWKUCIFM. We both have websites. Barbara's is penonfire.com. Mine is mariestone.com. I'm your host for the hour, Marie Stone, and we are doing what we do each and every Wednesday morning, which is chat with authors about their books, their process, their craft, whatever else comes up. I always love welcoming guests back. I had Joanne Beard on the show in 2018. She didn't have a book out then, but she was one of those writers whom I had so long adored, and I sought her out, and she graciously agreed to just come talk to me. So you can find that conversation on our archives. But suffice to say, we covered a lot of ground in that interview. And little did I know that she would have another collection coming. So it's my pleasure to welcome her back on today. Joanne is the author of the collection of autobiographical essays, The Boys of My Youth, and The Author in Zanesville. Her work has appeared in The New Yorker, Tin House, The Best American Essays, and other magazines and anthologies. She has won a number of awards and nonfiction fellowships from the John Simon Guggenheim Foundation, the New York Foundation for the Arts. She teaches writing at Sarah Lawrence College. Her latest is Festival Days. It came out in March, and it's published by Little Brown Books. It will drive a lot of our chat this morning. Joanne, welcome back.
Thank you.
So time is such a funny thing. I was just saying this to you. To say we talked in 2018 feels both not that long ago, just, you know, 2.5 years ago. And it also feels like we were all living on another planet back then. But, you know, I guess I could have said that 2.5 months ago was like living on another planet. So who knows? Time is a funny thing.
It really is. And I do remember when we talked a couple of years ago that I didn't have a book coming out. So it was a little bit unusual to be doing an interview without a book that I was stumping for. But I also didn't even have a book in my mind. And now I have a book, you know, basically in front of me. So it's really interesting what 2 or 3 years will do in one person's life.
I know we ended that interview with you saying, I'm never going to publish another book. It's just too hard. I'm not going to do it. And so I at the time I thought, I'm so glad I had you on because we're not going to get a chance again. And so when I saw the book, I was like, hooray. That's great.
I know I'm so full of crap in a lot of ways, but you know what? I didn't know that I was going to have a book until I somehow just realized that I had enough pages of pieces that I had published along the way to create a book. So I didn't have to set out to write a book. A book just sort of materialized out of, you know, 2 decades writing work. So I couldn't have anticipated it at that moment, but now it's a reality.
I sort of pictured it like you, you know, having all of these children and raising them and releasing them into the world. And then you were like, hey, you should all come back for a family reunion.
Right. Right. This is my family reunion. I'm so glad. Actually, I'm just really happy that all of those pieces that, you know, landed here and landed there are all in one place so that I feel like I've sort of done a service to them in some way by hauling them back out into the light.
Well, I've heard you say, we can get into this in a minute, but I've heard you say that the pieces were sort of, they certainly weren't randomly assembled, but they kind of came together and there, you know, there wasn't necessarily a cohesion or a thought or an intent to do a collection, mm-hmm. as you said, but they do so feel like they're in conversation with each other. So many of these pieces feel like they were in conversation with each other, but maybe that's just the beauty of the subconscious mind.
It might be the beauty of the reader's mind, you know, that when you sit down with a book that's been put together like that, with one piece follows another, that you bring your own sense to it as a reader and try to make something coherent out of it. And, you know, that's part of the best collaboration of all, really, is between the writer's mind and the reader's mind.
So before we dive into the book, we didn't get a chance to talk last time kind of about how you grew up and what you were kind of like as a kid. Our last talk, you alluded to this kind of desperate melancholy you had as a child. And I was just wondering if we could go back in time a little bit to talk about those early days and see if sort of the lens through which you viewed the world back then has kind of been an enduring thing, or if it's shifted over time, or I'm just curious about that whole background.
Yeah. Well, I think I don't actually remember that part of the conversation. I've blocked it somehow. But just that kind of existential angst that I felt as a kid, that actually I think so many kids feel and so many people feel, is truly something that is just part of my mental and emotional makeup. And so I started out that way, and I will undoubtedly end that way. And you know, there was a piece that I wrote that was many, many years ago, like in the mid-90s or something, that ended up in The Voice of My Youth. It's a short piece called Behind the Screen, about being in the backyard with my parents when I was, you know, I would say like maybe 8 years old or something, and having this feeling of existential terror when I was in the presence of the sublime. And for me, in that moment, the sublime was both the night sky in the summer, and perhaps the sublime was also being in my family in some way, like staring at my family at the backs of their heads. But it was also seeing this spectacular display of fireworks. And whereas being in the presence of the sublime might make some people feel happy, it always has made me feel a slight sense of dread and terror. And part of that, I think, is because just an awareness of immensity of the universe and the tininess of me, which is a banal way of saying it, but it's a kind of shorthand. And so I've tried to grapple with that in my writing, to try to sort of describe it in a way that's effective. And I don't think I ever have been able to get at that. And as a memoirist and a personal essayist, it's kind of strange, because it's probably the most important thing about my character and my makeup. And yet I don't know how to approach it effectively to write about it.
It's interesting you say that, because as you were talking about the beautiful conversation between writer and reader, I was always, as a kid, like as a really little kid, super obsessed with death. I always have been. I mean, from like the age of 4. And because nobody could answer the question for me, you know, what happens? My parents could answer all kinds of questions, but they couldn't answer that. And the doctor, I think I went to my doctor and I was like, you must know, you're a smart man. And I went to a minister and I was like, you must know. And they all kind of didn't know. They said, well, I believe. I'm like, I don't care about your beliefs. Like, I want to know what happens. Tell me the truth.
Yeah.
And so conversation, that's the conversation I felt like I was having with this book, which is kind of the same thing, but kind of a different thing, I guess.
Well, yeah, what I was thinking when you said that is this idea that we want to know what happens. Yeah, I've always had a sense of dread about death. I don't know why I can't embrace the idea, but we sort of do know what happens. I mean, if you set religious beliefs aside, which I hope we can do for a few minutes, what we know is that we end. That's it. That's the bottom line. We end. And that's the part that feels so, or felt, I'm going to put it in the past tense out of hopefulness. We felt the sort of dread and the horror of that. And when you're a little kid, it's really overwhelming to imagine that this self that you're just getting to know actually is going to have to end, that you're going to be asked to step off the stage at some point and not exist anymore. It's still a little bit hard to get my head around it.
And that might be the same thing we're talking about with your, you know, looking up at the night sky and feeling so small or insignificant in the grand whole, or, you know, the vastness of the universe puts you in kind of a melancholic, like it's awe-inspiring, but it's also super intimidating, or I don't know what the word is, but I think we're getting, you know, that reader writer conversation is getting at the same thing through kind of two different tunnels. It's overwhelming. It just feels overwhelming. This book felt so hot to me. Like I felt like I had to keep putting it down. It just felt like I kept touching the electrical wire of what I'm really afraid of over and over again in a bunch of different ways. Mm-hmm. And so,
It's a universal, really, what we've been talking about. And some people are better at keeping it at a reasonable distance and saying to themselves, either, you know, deliberately or subconsciously, just saying, look, this is the way it is. And you have to get past it and live your life as best you can. And others of us, me included, sort of think about it a lot and bring it front and center more than is perhaps healthy to do so.
I always call it death rehearsal. I keep trying to rehearse either my own or other people's death. I'm like, if I think about it enough, maybe I can make it less, I don't know, like less scary, but maybe I can make it less mystifying. You know, if I keep going through every permutation of how it could happen or what it will feel like.
Right.
Maybe I can.
No, you want to prepare, right?
Want to prepare,
like preparedness training. And, you know, people now are trying to demystify it by mystifying it. Like the people who, and I confess that I'm very interested in reading about this right now, the people who are using psilocybin and other mind-expanding drugs to try to explore their own feelings of anticipation of not being permanent, like i.e. dying. And I find that really interesting, this idea of demystifying it by going deeper into the mystical. So I don't know. I do think it's a universal, and that it's something that right now, maybe it's because I'm a baby boomer, I'm a certain age where we're all bumping up against it, but it seems like everybody I know is thinking about this stuff right now.
Well, I think it's the pandemic in part. I mean, we've right. had a year or 15 months now to sit in our homes and really contemplate mortality. You know, I mean, I think it's very hard to come out of this year without seeing refrigeration trucks parked in Manhattan and, you know, a daily death ticker at the bottom of our news screens every night and not really have. That's why I think this is such an interesting collection to come out at this time, because I know obviously none of these pieces were written anywhere close to the pandemic. And yet it feels so relevant to so many, you know, I guess we should let the listeners in if they have not yet picked up the book, a little bit about what we're talking about here. I can backfill, but I think it's the right book for this time that we're all processing, kind of this trauma that we've been mentally playing out a lot of permutations of death, either of loved ones or of ourselves, over the last year. And that really is what a lot of these pieces in here are doing as well.
Right. And many of us who have led fairly protected lives and lifestyles have been asked, you know, very recently and over the last year to actually sit down in front of our TVs or in front of our phone screens and watch somebody being, you know, murdered in front of us.
Mm-hmm. Mm, right.
So it does change the way people think. I mean, it has to, it should, it needs to.
Right.
No, it's really been a year for the record books, I think.
Yeah. And I think for a lot of people who don't have the kind of language or experience to process a lot of it, because I do know you're right. I think a lot of people, unlike you and I, probably don't dwell on this topic mentally for 50 years of their lives. Yeah. So I think it was kind of a nice way to give people access to talk about, think about, process some of those emotions through these pieces. But like I said, I did have to put it down a lot and just say, oof, that's a lot. I have to take a rest here and there.
I just want to say about that, a number of people have told me that. And I think that That's something I couldn't really have anticipated, but each of the pieces is its own separate little world because they were written, years apart and at different points in my life and for different reasons. And so when you put them all together, I think it does have that aspect to it that it feels a little bit dense, maybe, and a little bit relentless. But I just want to say that for the writer, it didn't feel relentless or dense at all because, there were years between them, or at the very least, there were months between them.
Well, that's why I asked that question towards the beginning about the lens through which you saw the world as a kid and whether that has shifted or changed, because I was wondering about that in respect to, I know these pieces were written over 20, I think you said 22 years. And if you felt like you were coming to, it's all very different material, but if you felt like your attitudes about mortality, yours or others, have changed or morphed as you move down life's timeline, as you experience more, or if you feel like your lens as a kid was kind of ossified, fossilized over time, and that is the lens through which you view mortality and kind of life's big questions.
Well, definitely, I think I haven't gotten too far beyond that original sort of sense of dread, although I've lived a happy life. So I do think that for me, just because of the way my mind works and because of my love of literature and art, that's where I go when I try to work anything out. I'm not saying that I go there as a writer. I say there I go there as a reader. So I have made it sort of my business to read a lot of books about, I don't know, different kinds of consciousness, about what it means to die. Writing the piece about the man who jumped out of his window during a fire and saved his own life, that was really written as a way of exploring the idea of going all the way to your moment of death and then getting a reprieve and getting to live. And what does that mean? Now, in terms of that essay, I know what that meant for him. I didn't exactly write that part of the essay. I wrote a little bit of it, but in my interviews with him, that's what I was really curious about. And we actually spent a lot of time talking about that aspect of it. And that was really not for the piece, but it was just for me to understand as a human being.
How did you find him? We should, I
I
guess we
met
should
him.
introduce the story a little bit, but yeah, I'm curious
Right.
about that.
Right. It's called Werner, and his name is Werner Hayflick, and he lived in Manhattan, and I lived in upstate New York, and we met one summer at a writing colony in New York State. And I just heard his story at the dinner table one night. Just as a matter of course, people were talking about certain things, and his story started to come out, and it was riveting. The whole room was riveted to it. And even though I didn't know him very well at the time, I asked him if he would let me write about it because I was really interested in it and wanted to imagine his story for myself in that deep way that you imagine things that you're trying to write about. And he gave me permission. And so I spent, 2 or 3 years thinking about what happened to him and grappling with those kind of existential questions that event sort of threw into high relief. And writing about it was really, really fun.
And so there were a lot of aspects of the story beyond the night itself when his apartment, 2 or 3 stories down below him, caught on fire and he was trapped above the fire and he had to make the decision, to stay or go, and he decided to go, and obviously
He survived it.
well enough, yes.
Yeah, he survived it.
But he had been a gymnast, he had a jump another jump off of a bridge at
Yes.
some point. So all of that is biographical, yes, that just serve the story, or are you allowing yourself to invent to enhance the story?
Well, those things were true. There were other things maybe that I imagined my way through that were less about Werner and more about me. And I think that it's fair to say with the piece about Werner and with a similar piece in the book about a woman named Sherry Tremble who died of cancer with an assisted suicide, that in both of those cases, even though I tried to adhere very closely to the events of the person's life, I also imagine my own way into the story for my own edification, actually. And what probably ended up happening was that in each of those pieces, the Werner character and the Sherry Tremble character both became sort of composites of them and of me, of some kind of third character that was a little my imagination, a little their story, and then something, I hope, an amalgamation of the two that became its own kind of character. I know that's complicated, and I think you would have to have read the pieces to understand really what I'm trying to describe, but that's as close as I can come to justifying what I did in those two pieces of heavily creative nonfiction writing.
Yes, I think it's such an interesting, I mean, a lot of people I know talk to you about this kind of genre bending new third thing that you've created between the essay, the story, you know, between fiction and nonfiction. And when I was reading it, I was like, who, you know, kind of who cares, right? There's a third truth. There are facts and there are experiences. And then there's the truth that underlies all of that, that really has nothing to do with, you know, what literally may have happened or what people literally may have felt in the moment. And I just love that we can blur at a time in our social discourse when we're blurring gender. I think it's also really cool to blur genre right now because it seems truer.
That's really interesting. And, you know, I've given this a lot of thought as a teacher, as somebody who teaches kind of personal essay writing to students and with students, you know, learning with students, where we look at all kinds of work that appeared out in the world before, you know, we bring it into the classroom. So it's not just their work, but it's a broad spectrum of nonfiction kinds of writing. I find that I do care about these issues as a reader. Like, I think a lot about, like, I wonder how much of this is true. I wonder how much is imagined. And I find that I do care, but as a writer, I don't care. I don't care what I'm doing when I'm doing it. I'm seeking something else, and I can't even maybe put words to what it is, but it's not consistent. Like, my feeling about nonfiction as a reader is not consistent with my feeling about nonfiction as a writer. So I have a bit of a contradiction there, but I don't care because I like thinking about these things, you know, and because, you know, I'm not going to try to dictate what kind of work I produce, because it's hard enough for me just to produce the work at all.
Right. Well, it's interesting. I read the first three stories. I'll call them stories for lack of a better accurate phrase. I read the first three pieces as a triptych. The first piece, we should say, is it's called Last Night, and it's about a woman who has to make a decision about putting her dog down. And the second is Werner, and the third is Sherry. And so all three of them were really concerned to me, in my mind, in this moment of, is it time? When is it time? Is it time now? Is it time now? And obviously there are about a million other things, but that grappling with the end, walking towards the end, knowing it's the end,
right,
and that threshold of there's a decision to be made in all three of these, and when is it time to make that decision? So I kind of read all three of them through that lens, but obviously they're each their own lovely, lovely piece. But when I heard that you didn't necessarily put them together consciously in that way. I was like, oh, but they're so perfect. The three of those stories are in such great conversation with each other. I don't know if that's just a reader observation or if it was ever a writer observation to you.
It wasn't a writer observation. And again, it goes back to that idea of the reader bringing a kind of, you know, collaborative coherence to the story. I can't remember how. I just remember that I printed all of these things out. I had to collect them from here and there. And then I printed them out. And then I just laid them on a table and tried to figure out if there was a coherent order in the collected body of work. And I moved them around a lot, but I never came up with anything that felt particularly coherent, except that I wanted the book to end with Festival Days, because that was the longest piece.
Well, and I thought it was really lovely to start with Last Night, because there's an image of the dog. It's the dog's last night. And there's an image of the dog going in circles and in circles and in circles. She can't get comfortable or disoriented. And that circle metaphor seemed to circle the other pieces of the book, that is kind of how our minds work. When we are either coming to the end of something or coming to a decision about something, our minds keep working over and working over. And then you kind of had, you know, these really lovely palate cleanser pieces, craft pieces. I think they were probably talks that you gave to your students about writing that were set pieces in the middle of the book. For our writing, our listeners who are writers out there, they're very comforting. The two craft pieces are very, felt like I got permission to procrastinate, which is really a wonderful.
You always have my permission to procrastinate. It's an important part of the process. And yes, there are two essays in there that are craft talks that I wrote. I can't speak extemporaneously when I'm giving a talk at school or at anybody's school. So I have to write a whole new essay every time I go to a school to talk to them about the craft of writing. So I just decided that there were a couple of those talks that I felt like had valuable information about how to grapple with the idea of writing an essay if you're a student and if you don't have the kind of confidence to just follow your thoughts, then the talks that I gave were sort of form following content talks, where I was trying to illustrate how you might begin with an idea and then move all the way through an essay, just collecting, you know, thoughts and images along the way, and then turning it into an essay that means something at the end. I don't know if I actually succeeded in that, but they came as close to succeeding as I can get at that. And so I put them in the book. And also, if I can just be completely frank, I needed all the pages I could get in order to bind the book, you know, sure, because my output is so small. So I gathered in, you know, everything basically that I had.
Thank God, because we got it all. Yeah, no, I think.
Thank you.
Right. My guest this morning is Joanne Beard. The book is Festival Days. You are listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. Well, maybe we step back. Oh, we kind of glazed past Sherry, and that was, you know, that was such a lovely piece in the book. Tell me about meeting. I think you met Sherry's daughters, and they are the conveyors of her story. Tell me a little bit about how you met them and, you know, getting their mother's story from them and what it was that, you know, felt sticky enough about that story to you that you wanted to kind of take it on.
Right. Well, I only met one of her daughters. I met Sarah Tremble, was a friend of a friend. And Sherry's good lifelong friends, Linda and Wayne Peterson, also lived, you know, very near Sarah in Iowa City. So I just traveled to Iowa City and I met with them for, you know, the better part of a week. singly, I met with them, and then all together, I think I met with them once, and just got the bare bones of Sherry's story, like essentially what happened to her in the course of her illness. And then I think that mostly Sarah told me the story of who Sherry was as a person. And then I just came home with all these notebooks full of notes. And I just really got to know the character of Sherry through the writing of her story and through the, you know, really moving and penetrating things that the people who loved her had to say about her and about, you know, the really sort of awful circumstances that defined the end of her life, which is that she was young and she was not ready to die, but like many people, she got terminal cancer. And unlike many people, she was unable to tolerate pain medication. So her cancer involved a great deal of suffering. And she decided that she wanted out and she wanted to get the help of a doctor to do that. And at that point, the only doctor who was willing and available to help people who needed to commit assisted suicide was Jack Kevorkian. And she was incredibly brave, and I don't know quite how to describe her, but she was absolutely somebody who, if she decided that she was going to check out that way, she would go straight to somebody like Jack Kevorkian and say, I need your help. And he did help her. He did.
You said the original image, I think I read somewhere. So when she was making the drive, I think, did she live in Iowa City and she was driving to, yeah, to Detroit?
Yeah.
And it was an excruciating drive because she was, by this point, you know, not in a good way. And so her head was in her hands, I think, for most of that drive. And I think that was the opening image that you said kind of gripped you.
It was, because she was a friend of Sarah, her daughter was a friend of a friend. I sort of was tracking, you know, that her mother was sick. And then I just said to my friend one day, how's Sarah's mom? And she said, oh, she died. And then she told me, you know, that they had taken her up north to Kevorkian. And, you know, you have an idea in your mind what that means. There's something very determined about that, and something a little outré, like, oh my God, she went up there to Dr. Kevorkian and had assisted suicide. But then I said, just, oh, what was that like? And my friend said, well, Sarah said she had her head in her hands the entire drive up there, which is 9 hours. And suddenly, with this kind of zooming clarity, I realized, oh, right. This is, people only do this when they're absolutely desperate. This isn't about assisted suicide, like, you know, something that you hear on the news. This is incredibly personal and harrowing and particular to one person in every single case. It's not a news story. It's a real person. And that's what made me want to write about it. The idea that it would be an extremely particular story about one unique woman is what interested me. And of course, you know, going back to what we talked about earlier in our hour here, you know, this idea of death and facing your death and having to carry your children and your best friends almost all the way into it with you out of necessity. So it all, you know, I lost my mother in a different way than Sarah Tremble lost hers, but it was through cancer, and it was watching her ebb away and not being able to turn the tide. And so it felt actually really good to me to research that piece and to write it.
I can't remember who I was talking to, but we were having the conversation about how and where you take the reader into the room where something is happening. Like you can leave the reader outside the door and say, this is what happened behind the door. Mm-hmm. Or you can take the reader all the way to the foot of the bed, or you can take the reader into the mind of the subject. And whatever stage you decide to do, the reader is either a witness to the event and experiencing it alongside the person who is experiencing it, or the event has already been pre-digested and it's kind of safe. And, you know, you can say, this is what happened and it's okay. And your choice in all of these pieces is to take us all the way as witness. We are sitting there with them. It is not safe. It is not pre-digested, right? We know exactly. And in some ways it's comforting. Like in some ways, like I said, in this death rehearsal that I am obsessed with doing, it feels kind of safer. Like, okay, if you know what it is, at least you can wrap your brain around it. It's no longer mysterious, but it's hard. I mean, I think that was what led to, you have to put the book down quite a bit because it's electrifying.
Right. And the other thing that I'll say about that, that was very well said, by the way, is that before you take the reader there, you take yourself as the writer there. And I do remember the end of writing the Sherry Tremble piece where the door closes behind her family. And I entered that moment with Sherry. And I'm not trying to sound woo-woo or mystical. I had to go there in my imagination. I had to follow her there. I owed it to her. But I wasn't completely convinced I was going to write it. I thought as I was going through the writing of the essay, in all the months and years before I got to that last passage, I thought, oh, well, when the door closes, I'll go with them and I'll get back in the van and we'll drive away and we'll leave Sherry to whatever her fate was. But you know what? In the moment when I got there, I wanted to be with Sherry. Mm-hmm. And I also wanted to create a reality for Sherry, because we can't know, but I wanted to create a reality for her that would honor who I thought she was as a person. And that would also, in some tiny way, perhaps make it possible for her loved ones to imagine her end, you know, which couldn't have been more than a few minutes after they left her. I wanted them to be able to imagine it as something that was calm. And I'm sure it was. I am sure it was. I wouldn't have written anything that I didn't think had a kind of psychological truth or acuity to it. But it was just like, by then I loved Sherry so much and I loved her family so much that that was as much for the writer, I guess, as it was for the reader.
Well, and it's a tragedy that she died when they couldn't. I mean, nowadays, I think they could stay with her and be there. And then they could not. This was in the 90s, I think, right?
So it was against the law.
Yeah.
It was against the law, although nobody had any interest in hurting people like Sherry or her family. But they did have, they had a lot invested in the idea of stopping Kevorkian from what he was doing, because it looked a lot like murder, and it still does tread a line, you know? So there were just rules that people had to adhere to.
And the other thing this story got to is, I think a lot of us we say we're afraid of death. I think what we're really afraid of is dying and all of the things that lead up to a death. And maybe most of us, once the death threshold comes, it's not as bad as you say, it's nothing, you know, if we take religion out of it. But the dying is something. And that's the other thing this piece did so well, is it didn't sugarcoat that part of it. As you say, she couldn't have pain medications. And so we got to live through all of that. And this role of memory. And I would just love to have a conversation about memory, because so many of your pieces are so interesting in how we experience a moment. And of course, we imbue it with all of our memories. I was just listening to this really interesting conversation with Ishiguro and Lisa Joy, who is the creator of Westworld. And they were having a conversation about memory in the context of AI. But I was thinking about that interview they did in the context of reading a lot of your work and how we experience memory. And they were doing this thought experiment of when you look back on a memory from your own life, like your first kiss with the lover you're with now, and you try to remember all of the very specific details about it and what you were wearing and all of that. Do you experience it in the third person or in the first person? And I always think I experience things in the third person, and just how that point of view shift in your own head of thinking about your own memories changes the experience so much that when you are calling those up to a current situation you're living through, as you do, just that point of view shift changes so much. And I was just thinking of that in a lot of these pieces where the backstory is imbuing the forward momentum of the current story in such interesting and fresh ways, and how that role of memory kind of shapes the current momentum of the current work. I don't even know what the question is in there.
But. Yeah. Well, there are so many things to respond to in that. Like, first of all, I think all the time about memory because it's sort of a cornerstone of the kind of writing I do. But my thinking about it has shifted a lot over the years. For instance, I tell myself that I have a really good memory because, and I think that the reason that I say that is because I have a vivid imagination and I have a visual imagination. And it's why I started out really as a visual artist, because that felt natural to me. I wasn't very good at it, but nevertheless, I have a super visual imagination and I flatter myself that I have a great memory, but in fact, I don't. And every time I think I remember something really profoundly and truly and with great detail, I will discover that my memory is wrong. It's completely wrong. I mean, I've had my sister actually produce photographs and go, "See?" And she, you know, and I go, "Oh, I have a different photograph in my head." And she's like, "Yeah, well, that's in your head. This is real." And the fact is that when I am doing my writing, my job is to imagine my way into the world that I'm writing about, whether it's Werner's world or Sherry's or my own. I'm imagining my way into it. And in fact, what happens is that that picture that I get in my head begins to feel like memory instead of like something that I've created out of my imagination. So I'm kind of getting to a point in my life where I don't trust myself at all. It's why I can't call my work fiction or nonfiction, because the lines truly are blurred for me. And they might be blurred because I've been doing it for so long that I just broke down the barricades between those genres. Or it might be that, and I'm not even making a joke here, that I'm old enough now that my brain is just simply not as sharp as it was. And things that used to be precise are a little blurry for me now. But whichever way it is, I find it really, really interesting.
Oh, I agree. And I think that does get back to our earlier conversation about what difference does genre make when the piece feels true. What difference does it make if she's wearing a red dress or a green dress? But I do think this idea of memory and how many times you call a memory to mind changes each time, right? Just the act of calling it up to your head shifts it again and shifts it again. And so actually, the more time you call a specific memory up, probably the more times it doesn't bear any resemblance to it.
Exactly. It begins to morph.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, you can either fight that or you can just go with it. And I've just decided to go with it.
And probably when you put it up against something else, when you juxtapose it in these pieces, just setting it alongside something else would also shift it, right? You couldn't help but view it differently. So yeah, I just think, you know, as a philosophy major, so I just think this is all very interesting. But yeah, I mean, that really is the strength of all of your work, but certainly the strength of all of these pieces is how characters process the current events they are living through with the aid of what has come before them that they can draw upon for strength, insight, whatever it is that they need to get through the current situation, which I think is as human. It's what we, it's kind of what we do. Do you ever, I didn't do that. I probably know the answer to this, but I was thinking it would be interesting and I kind of mentally did it, but I didn't physically do it to storyboard one of your stories to see, okay, here's the forward momentum of what's happening in, you know, whatever real time means. And then here are all of the drop down backstory memory things that inform this event. I thought if I actually wrote that out on a timeline, it would be very intriguing. I don't know if you ever go through that exercise.
No, I've never done that. I think that I've done a version of that as a teacher when I just say, okay, how did this essay work its magic on us? And then we begin to pull it apart. But I would seriously be afraid to try to do that with my own work, because there is something about literature, and I'm aiming to write literature. And there's something about literature that doesn't want to be demystified,
yeah,
that wants the mystery to exist. And I feel that way about my own writing. Like, I'm not sure where this came from, but let's just leave it there. And let's just say, you know, it's earned its right to be there. And I don't want to think about it too much.
Well, to that point a little bit, another aspect of this book, and I can't remember if it struck me as much as it did in Boys in Their Youth when I was reading it, but maybe because climate change and the planet have been on my mind more when I was reading the current work. You have a very interesting relationship, I think, with the planet that feels to be more expansive, meaning you certainly have deep relationships with animals, and that came through all of these pieces. But also I feel like the natural environment, that you are much mm-hmm. more ecological than egological about your view of what the planet is, that you have a relationship with trees and with plants and with mm-hmm. the landscape that is much more inclusive, I think, than... I don't remember if that was always there in the prior work as well, or if that is kind of a new and evolving interest of yours.
It's not. It's always been there. You know, it's always been there only because I've always cared about animals. And, you know, I like people, but I'm very mad at us at this point. And I don't really care that much what happens to people where the environment is concerned. We've created our own mess here. And we continue to create it every day when we send all this plastic trash to the landfill. So I have less sympathy for us than I do for the other creatures on the planet who have no control over how we're destroying it. But I just spent the hour before I started talking to you. I live out in the country. I live, you know, in an extremely rural area. But no matter how rural you are, civilization is, you know, encroaching. And we have a woods behind our house. And they're cutting down thousands of trees in those woods in order to, you know, do things, power line type of things. And I listened to the chainsaws and I listened to them and I had arguments with the guys. And I finally just lost it today. And I just went out there and started really screaming at this guy. I'm like an old gray-haired lady. And I was screaming at a guy who's like maybe 22 years old or something, working for the county, you know, pushing trees over with a bulldozer. And my partner came out and he sort of like took over. Like I said, okay, you talk to him now. I'm going back to the barn. And he came to the barn later and he said, don't do that anymore. Please just don't do that. You know, don't go yelling at some kid about what he can't help but do. And I felt really bad about it for about, I don't know, 5 minutes. And then I thought, I don't care. I don't care about humans as much as I do those trees that are being knocked over and cut down. And I don't know. Anyway, see, now I've gone off on a rant again, but I can't help it. You know, when you listen to chainsaws going, you can really like, if you listen to chainsaws for about 3 days in a row, which I've been doing, you can really work up kind of a bit of a hatred for your fellow man. And so I'm working on that. I'm working on that. After I get off this call, I'm gonna take a bath and think about my own behavior today and try to get better.
Well, the last time we talked, when I asked your book recommendation, it was Richard Powers' The Overstory. So I understand. I understand. You
know, great, great book.
Yes, right. To this very point about trees and their role. To that point, I mean, for as much work as you do in the nonfiction memoir realm, do you feel any, I don't know if responsibility is the right word. Do you feel any, I'll just use it because I can't think right now, but any responsibility as writer to convey some of these notions in your work, or is that just not your job?
Well, you know, I don't know if responsibility is the word, but when I have an opportunity to put my political agenda out there, I feel very, very excited by it. Like I feel an internal fire when I have the chance to do that. Now, not just the little rant that I went on about the poor 22-year-old, but when I have a chance maybe to say something that I feel about animal rights or about, I don't know, whatever, vegetarianism or something, I feel excited. I feel like, wow, if this forum, I guess you would call it, of being a writer, that means that sometimes people like you call me and ask me questions and other people driving in their car someday listen to my answers. It gives me this like very excited feeling, like whoever knew that I would be able to actually be able to advocate for animals.
Yeah.
I don't know. It seems like a profound thing. I'm not very good at it because I'm not that intellectual. It's all just feelings. And I try not to let the sort of cooing nature of my love of animals in there because it turns people off. But I do have that side of me too.
Well, and I think there's an urgency that I feel like my own internal answer would have changed over the last 5 years. That I do feel like if people have a platform, you know, maybe not in their art itself, because that's its own thing. But if you have a platform, I am coming of the mind that you should use it, you know, for good, because we're at an inflection point, right? I mean, we really.
Right.
So, yeah, to whatever extent we can, I feel like it is our obligation to say something when we have the opportunity to do it. But
right. And if you're somebody like, you know, Richard Powers and writing this incredible book about trees, you know, you can't do better than that. Like you put your passion on the page and all kinds of people read it and are moved and changed by it. That's really great. I can't claim to that, but there's a version of it that I can do. Like I can make people, I think in my writing, you know, think about their own dogs maybe in a way.
Maybe. You know, the thing that I love about animals in especially the animals juxtaposed to the subject matter of a lot of these books is a lot of these pieces is that animals aren't really aware of their own mortality, right? They don't know what's mm-hmm. coming for them. And so they're just a nice counterpoint to the very heaviness. I think there's an animal in each one of these stories, and they don't all meet with good ends, you know, and they don't know it. And that innocence of not knowing what's coming for them, I don't know, it's just extra heartbreaking.
Right. But you know what? I would have completely agreed with that not long ago. But now for some reason my thinking is morphing on that too. And I think we don't actually know what they feel or what they think. And so it's possible that it isn't that they don't know, it's that they have a different relationship to it.
Mm. I should open my expansiveness of my worldview. It's coming a little late in
It's
life.
helpful. It's helpful as life, you know, drags on to try to
That's
drag
right.
yourself to a new way of thinking at the same time.
Right. Well, we were supposed to spend half of this lovely hour on craft, and I just totally neglected to do that because I was so interested in your philosophical takes on life. So I really apologize to our listeners that we did not do a ton of craft talk in here.
We'll do it again someday.
Let's do it again someday. I should say again, if listeners want to pull up our last chat, there is a little bit more craft talk in there. But one thing I will mention, since you brought up your partner, Scott Spencer is also a writer who you live with. And you had something that in another interview that I just wanted to highlight because your approaches to writing are so very different. And he, you know, kind of sounds like he writes fast and furious and a lot and then edits in the aftermath, and you write very methodically, slowly, and, you know, perfect a gem sentence before you move on. And you had described it as him saying, you know, he approaches his work as yes, and you approach your work as saying no, because.
Yes, and I know. It's sad, isn't it?
I really like that, I mean, it just sums up the two different approaches that writers have. I think it was just a succinct, wonderful way to view it.
Yeah, it's very good for me to see how he approaches the work. And it's very good for me to be exposed to the kind of fiction that he writes, although I really like his nonfiction too, but he doesn't do very much of that anymore. But no, it's enlightening to me to be in the presence of that every day.
It's amazing. So is he one of those who, you know, you have to write 1,000 words a day sort of writers?
He's one of those who gets up in the morning and can't wait to get to his computer. And then he works at it all day, but he's not sitting there all day. You know, he Yeah. gets up, he moves around, he does other things. He sees people, he talks to people, he has other demands on him, but he never gets far enough away from the book that he's working on to feel that he's, you know, being pulled out with a different tide the way I do constantly, because, you know, I have a more distant relationship with my own writing and my own process.
Yeah.
It's good
yeah.
for me to see what he does. It's helpful.
Right. Is there anything that one piece of essential wisdom that you pass along to your students in their many, many years of nonfiction memoir training? One piece of advice that you can leave our listeners with?
Well, the thing about nonfiction for me and the thing that I feel about my students, because, you know, people come to graduate school and even the writers in our undergraduate program, some of them come there just to learn to write, not to become writers with a capital W. And I think that writing a certain kind of nonfiction is really good for the soul, and that it makes for a better life, because it requires that at least in your work, you're living an examined life and you're thinking about who you are in relationship to the world, and you're pushing past what's obvious and you're looking at what's behind the story. And I think that it makes for a better life. And I think it actually makes for, you know, it makes for better people, if I dare say that.
Yeah.
So that's my advice, is just keep doing it.
You had pointed out an essay by Christian Wyman, I hope I'm saying his name right, The Limit, that you taught. And I just wanted to point that out to people. I went back and read that, and what an incredible piece of work. I think that's one of the pieces that you routinely teach, you said.
I teach two versions of it. I teach the long play version and then the edited version that appeared in Harper's. And it's really instructive in a million different ways, but it's also just a really beautiful piece about what I was just talking about, like learning to understand yourself, what you come out of, who you are, and what the world is all about, your own personal world is all about. So yeah, I really believe in that guy. I think he's a great artist.
Well, the last time we talked, you said you weren't going to publish anymore. So I hope you were lying then. And if you say it again, I hope you're lying now so we get to do this again.
Well, we'll see, I guess. I'm not saying anything ever again that I can use to contradict myself later. So
fair.
We'll see.
Wonderful.
Thank you so much.
Joanne Beard, thank you so much. This was wonderful. That was Joanne Beard. The book is Festival Days. It is out and available now, published by Little Brown. That's all the time we have for today. We will be right back here with you next Wednesday morning. So until next time, thanks so much for joining me. Have a great day.